I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe David Grant Noble. He's an archaeological writer and photographer. He's editor of the new book, Living the Ancient Southwest, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore talking about the book and signing books on Sunday, this coming Sunday at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. So how did you conceive of this book?
I conceived of doing publications with essays about the Southwest maybe 30-some years ago when I was working at the School of American Research, now the School for Advanced Research. And I started a series of publications called Exploration that had articles by anthropologists and Native Americans about different topics in the Southwest. And that series went on for about 10 years, maybe a little longer, and then it stopped. And there was a new order at the school, and time went by. And one of the publications I did was called New Light on Chaco Canyon. And it was fairly successful. It was in print for many years. And in 2003, I met the new head of the publishing division at the school, and I said, you know, James, this is James Brooks, who later became head of the school, if you reprint this one more time, you're going to have to change the title to the same old Light on Chaco Canyon. So that conversation led to a new series of books about the Southwest written by the primary researchers and by Native Americans out of their oral traditions and Native knowledge, called the Popular Southwest Archaeology Series. And there are seven of those.
Now, to what extent are Native people represented as voices in archaeology? I mean, historically, archaeologists have been sort of people from universities coming in from the outside and studying people, but not the people studying themselves so much.
Yeah. When you go back to the early part of the last century and into the 19th century, Native Americans were very much involved in archaeology, but as laborers on a dig. And very seldom as consultants or as archaeologists, as scientists. This continued far too long, well into the 1900s. But about 20 years ago, the legislation was passed in Washington called the Native American Graves Repatriation Act. And similar legislation was passed in states and cities and counties. We have very important laws here in Santa Fe and in Santa Fe County and the city and county that require archaeologists from universities, as you were saying, to consult Native Americans about how they do archaeology, how they treat burials, and what they do with the artifacts and human remains after a dig is over. And so some tribes in the Southwest, I'm not too sure about other parts of the country, but in the Southwest, some tribes are very much involved in archaeology now, and there are young people who are going to UNM and the University of Arizona and studying archaeology and becoming archaeologists. Other tribes and pueblos are more conservative, and they have a lingering reserve, you might say, or even hostility to the process of archaeology. They think that they know, they do know what they need to know about their own history, and the European scientific approach simply isn't interesting to them. So you have to answer a question like yours sort of on a case-by-case basis.
Right, right. Now, what geographical period and or geographical area and time period does this book cover?
The first chapter in the book, written by Stephen Sims, is about the Great Basin, which, as you know, is a desert, very, very severe desert. And it's about hunter-gatherers in the Great Basin.
Now, where is the Great Basin?
The Great Basin is in northern Utah and Idaho, and it covers something like 10% of the United States. It's a huge area, and it's about how Native Americans going back into thousands of years ago survived and subsisted in the Great Basin, where they found food and how they harvested it and how they prepared it to eat, and about their nomadic lifestyle. These were hunter-gatherers.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, people who were nomads in that area, which is a harsh place. I mean, it's a harsh place by our standards now with the technological infrastructure we have.
Yeah.
What was the nomadic life like? Who moved? Where did they move? How did they live?
They lived in small bands, usually extended families. And in a desert area like that, they traveled extensively. Hunter-gatherers who live in a more productive environment sometimes just stay in one place, such as along the seashore. But in the Great Basin and in other parts of the Southwest, they traveled a lot. They had a very wide territory that they exploited to gather, mainly to gather food and other resources, tools and so forth. So they had camps in various places where there were resources, quarries and food resources and hunting and so forth, that they would use annually or seasonally, sometimes for a few days or a few weeks, sometimes for a month or two, and then they'd move on to another camp. And they would keep many of their possessions in the camp so that they wouldn't have to carry them with them because they were pedestrians.
And it does reflect a kind of different concept of property and territory than what we might have now.
Oh, yes. Yes, they didn't have a concept of private property at all.
But at the same time, if they left stuff somewhere and somebody else took it, they'd probably come back and say, hey, where's my stuff?
Yeah, they would have. There probably was an honor system about that. I think that later on in the archaic period, when population grew and they began to bump into each other more, that would have become a problem. And also, that was the time period when they began to transition to growing food, becoming farmers. One thing that's interesting is that sometimes today, I mean, just quite recently in the news, farmers discover caches of tools in their fields when they're plowing that were made and finished and not used and were there as a resource for them to come back to, but then for some reason they didn't. There are a dozen or more of these caches. Some of them are quite famous.
What kind of tools were they making?
Well, they make cutting tools mostly. Knives and spear points.
Out of stone?
Out of stone, yeah. Stone like obsidian that is that flakes easily to a sharp edge.
Right.
And chert is another common stone.
And so what was their diet in the Great Basin, these nomadic people?
Yeah, you know, this would be a time to read a little passage about that.
Sure.
Would that be okay?
We're going to read, David Grant Noble is going to read from the book Living the Ancient Southwest.
And this paragraph is from a chapter called Making a Living in the Desert Southwest by Stephen R. Sims. Here it goes. The cuisine of the ancient Great Basin was, for the most part, simple, but probably less strange than the grislier stereotypes lead us to believe. On one hand, the native diet strikes modern Americans as strong and bitter. Yet on the other, its lack of fat and sugar makes it seem bland to modern sensibilities. Daily fare came mainly out of the stew pot. For most of antiquity, this pot was not ceramic, but a tightly woven, coiled basket, whose contents were heated with hot stones from the campfire. One could boil a basket full of water this way in less than 5 minutes. Ingredients varied by season, but the stew often began with a base of flour made from seeds such as Indian rice grass, blazing star, saltbush, and native bluegrass, to name just a few. The cook might lace this mush with bits of meat, typically rabbit. Greens and seasonings such as thistle, peppergrass, and tansy mustard added spiciness. In the fall and winter, stews might be based on pine nut meal, one of the delicacies of the year. The basketry stew pot embraced the fruits of a landscape that offered a variety of fresh foods rivaling that found in modern supermarkets.
That is interesting on so many levels. One of them, just simply that they made, they boiled water in a basket, in a woven basket.
Yes, and
do you have these baskets? I mean, did any of them survive?
Oh, yes, yeah. I've seen them at the museum here and at the School for Advanced Research Collections. What they did was they make a basket, it's a medium-sized basket, and then seal it with pine pitch and let that harden. And then they make a fire, and they heat rocks in the fire and drop them into the basket and then pull them out with tweezers or some kind of, and then put another hot rock in, and pretty soon you get boiling water. The way you notice these sites on the landscape is that there will be a hearth, and around the hearth there'll be burnt stones, and the stones turn reddish when they're burned, so that's a clue that they were cooking there.
And the idea that there was a wide variety of food is also kind of counterintuitive to what the cliches we think we know about native cuisine or native diets.
Yeah, yeah. There are so many edible native plants that we have lost. We non-Native Americans have lost track of and only eat a few of them. But they're just very rich. I remember one time I was going down to the Colorado River, or the Green River, I guess it was, and going down cliff after cliff in a truck, and came to this vast field. It must have been 50 acres, and it was in May, and the field was completely covered with Indian rice grass that was ready to harvest. And I suddenly realized, oh, yeah. 20 people would come here with baskets on their burden baskets, and they would harvest a huge amount of these tiny seeds.
And rice grass, is it similar to the rice we know as rice?
No. There's plenty of it around Santa Fe. Out where I live on West Alameda, there's rice grass growing along the side of the road. And it's a little tiny black seed. It looks like maybe buckshot. It's really small.
Okay.
It's hard to imagine eating it, but getting enough of it to make a meal. But
so how did people make it through the winter? I mean, we're talking about pretty long, hard winters. I mean, we're here in Santa Fe, and it's even rougher in Utah, Idaho, Nevada.
Yeah, the late summer and early fall were very important periods for gathering plants and also for hunting. And in some parts of the Southwest, and in fact, on the eastern edge of the Great Basin, the hunter-gatherers would go up into the Rocky Mountains and hunt elk and bighorn sheep and process them to a certain extent and then bring the meat down and keep it over the winter. They also made pemmican.
How did they preserve it?
Well, in the winter, they'd sometimes freeze it, just put it in the snowdrift, or they'd dry it. More commonly, they'd dry it and make pemmican. Pemmican was sometimes called desert fruitcake. And it's a combination of marrow, which is very nutritious as opposed to fat, and seeds and fruits mashed up together. And that preserves well, and it was a basic food to carry people through the winter. The hardest time of the year, Mary Charlotte, was in the spring, when the food had run out and before new plants were coming up that could be harvested.
Right.
So that was often a starving time.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, as we learned from your book, corn was an import from Mexico. When did it come to what is now the American Southwest, and how did it affect the way people lived?
The first corn was brought up about 2,000 or 2,500 years B.C. That's a lot earlier than anthropologists originally thought, but there are sites in southern Arizona along Interstate 10 near Tucson that have evidence of the cultivation of corn going back that far. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, here in the Rio Grande Basin around Santa Fe, corn didn't become an important food source until around 400 to 600 AD. So you've got 2,000 years span there. And it's not that agriculture is better than hunting and gathering. It's that sometimes you just don't need to bother to till fields and focus on one crop. And it's better, it's easier, and it's more nutritious and to continue hunting and gathering. So in the Rio Grande Valley, it was a very rich environment for hunting and gathering. And so it went on for a lot longer.
Interesting.
One reason to switch to agriculture is when the population became too great to make it practical to continue gathering plants.
So agriculture allowed for bigger populations.
Yeah, it did.
What led to population increases?
Well, it was rainfall, good rainfall, and good agriculture. And also corn is a product that can be made into mush so that a woman doesn't have to breastfeed as long as she would have if she were in a nomadic hunting-gathering situation. And they can make, the family could make mush, and the grandmother, let's say, in a camp or in a village, could feed the young children corn mush and free the mother to go out and do agriculture and so forth, and free her to stop lactating and to become pregnant again.
Right.
More quickly. Do you understand what I mean?
Which would lead to more...
More babies.
Population. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So, I mean, one of the things, looking at your book, we're talking to David Grant Noble about the book Living the Ancient Southwest, and you look at the photographs in it and the petroglyphs, and we'll get to the artistic part in a moment, but the, for example, cave dwellings, and you think... Okay, let's imagine living in a cave dwelling. When are you inside? When are you outside? What do you do all day? What's the difference between, is there a difference between public and private life, between work and personal life, or is it all completely communal? I mean, do we have a sense of what a family or a band's day was like?
Oh, we do to some extent, but, you know, I would give my left arm, or maybe my left finger.
don't do that.
to go back a few hundred years and just watch how people were living, let's say, in Frijoles Canyon in Bandelier, where they have both, where there were both pueblos, standard pueblos, and cave age or cave dwellings. So cave dwellings are really cozy. And they're also up on a cliff with a good view.
In the winter, are they cozy?
Well, they face south,
okay.
So they get passive solar heat, and they're small spaces, so a small fire makes quite a bit of heat compared to the big voluminous houses we have today. And they would put blankets over the doorway to hold the heat in. They had a vent to let the smoke out. It wouldn't seem to me not really too bad at all. You know, up around Dixon, there's a fellow who's made modern cave houses, or one at least, and I've been in it, and it is just a wonderful feeling to be in that. Of course, it's on a bigger scale than the cave dwellings at Bandelier.
Right. But, I mean, so you wake up in your cave on a very nice blanket. The sun's coming up. It's starting to get warm. Then what happens?
Okay, well, first of all, you don't just live in a cave. The cave was hewn out of the cliff into a room or a series of rooms. In front of it, which you don't see today at Bandelier, there were pueblos built in front. So the house was actually a lot bigger than what we see as a cave room today.
Okay.
They would get up, and I assume they would have breakfast. And then, you know, there would be a plaza, and the children would play in the plaza. or go out with their parents if they were old enough to work in the fields or to be there in the fields while their father and mother were working. When they got still older, the kids would go out, learn how to hunt, or the grandparents would teach them close to camp how to set traps to catch rodents and birds and so forth. And so they had plenty to do, and we think of them as not being schooled, but they did have schools, but the schools were, it was like homeschooling, taught by the grandparents and the parents, and by observation of how things were done and trying it and copying what was done and that kind of thing. There was a tremendous amount of education that went on, but it wasn't the kind that we have in a schoolroom with paper and pencil.
Right, right. Now, you do have a very sophisticated artistic tradition as handed down to us through pottery and through petroglyphs and rock art, and probably lots of ways that have been lost, too, if there were arts in materials that have decayed, which pottery doesn't. What do we know about the pottery, how it was used, why it was decorated in the way that it was?
Yeah, well, let me back up for just a sec and say that there were several things I wanted to accomplish in this volume, in the essays that I selected. There are 18 essays. And one was to have chapters on food production and gathering and cooking and that kind of thing. Another was about housing. Another was about art. And another faction was about native oral traditions and religion. So on the art score, there are three chapters that come to mind immediately. Two of them are about pottery. One on Mimbres pottery, and one on the pottery that was made around Flagstaff, what's called the Sinawa area, or the Hizatsanom area. And then there's a chapter on rock art by Polly Shasma. So the chapter on Mimbres pottery, which is probably the best known pottery for its artistry,
it's fantastic.
In the Southwest. It
yeah.
is, yeah. It is. And the Michel Hegman, who wrote that article, discusses how that pottery was made, but even more so what it means or how anthropologists try to interpret the meaning and the significance of these animal and bird and insect and human figures and abstract figures that are painted on the pottery. The Mimbres pottery is quite ordinary in terms of the actual bowls, but it's the painting on the potteries that makes it unique. And there isn't any other pottery that I am aware of in North America that has something like that. And the images of, let's say, animals, some of them are quite realistic, and some of them are abstracted to the point that they're fantastical. But you can still see basically what they are. For example, turtles. The paintings of turtles are so abstract that they become a design, purely a design element. The paintings on the Mimbres pottery of humans in many cases show the kind of life that you were asking me about a few minutes ago, what people were doing. It shows them making baskets and making nets to catch animals and having intimate relations and all kinds of things, fishing, hunting.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was so sophisticated, I mean, rivaling what we might call 20th century modern art and the sophistication of all the kinds of drawing and, you know, that combination of abstraction and realism that we thought was so innovative in Europe in the
Absolutely.
20th century. It's all there.
There. And which in says, 1000 AD.
Right. Yeah. I mean, which says that there was a lot of, or says to me that there was a lot of focus on art and representation and symbolism and thinking about meaning in a kind of, like having the time and you know, you're not just working all day. I mean, you have the time to make those kinds of artistic traditions which give meaning to your lives.
Yes, yes. And they relate probably to individuals. The imagery relates probably to individuals, maybe the individuals who made them, or for their children. It may be having to do with their ceremonies. There's been a lot of speculation by people 1,000 years later from a different culture about why they painted certain symbols and animals and birds and left out others. There's one pot at least that has a picture of a whale with its, even with its spout hole, its blowhole.
Right.
So, you know, that says, okay, it's 400 miles to the Gulf of California, say, where there you can observe whales from the shore. They were going out there, or they were hearing about it.
Yeah.
And that reveals something about their trade relations and travel. And
now, that seems like the kind of thing where you would really, if you were an archaeologist, want to be talking to the descendants of those people, because maybe some of those traditions carried on.
Yes, yeah. And, well, the Acoma people have a strong connection with the Mimbres in their traditions. And probably there are tribes in northern Mexico who also have traditions like around Casas Grandes in Chihuahua.
Right.
But it's hard anthropologically and archaeologically to connect ancient sites with modern Native American cultures.
We're talking to David Grant Noble about his book, Living the Ancient Southwest. Now, I was surprised to find a chapter on songs.
Oh.
I didn't think that was going to be in a book on archaeology.
Isn't that a wonderful chapter?
Yeah.
To me, that was... I was slapped on the wrist so many times for saying most unique, but it's a terribly original chapter. Written by two people from the Akumel Ootam culture in around Phoenix, also known as the Pima Indians. And it's very interesting because it's about their songs. This chapter is about the oriole sequence of songs, songs passed to them from by the oriole. And the oriole had revealed these songs to medicine men.
Now we're talking the bird.
The bird, yeah. They had revealed these songs to medicine men in dreams. And they tell about the landscape between the Phoenix area and the Colorado River, and which is to the west, northwest, and all the way to the Pacific coast. And the songs tell about trails between what the descendants of the Hohokam are a prehistoric group of Native Americans who lived in that area. Their descendants are the people who wrote this chapter. The trails that lead to the west coast and to the Colorado River, and the landscape that exists across that vast desert. And it's all transmitted today in the form of songs that were given to people by birds. And the oriole sequence of songs is just one of many. There are other sequences. It's a very rich tradition. And I've been in the Southwest and involved in anthropology and ethnography and so forth for almost over 40 years, and this chapter just absolutely bowled me over.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking as I was reading it that, I mean, it's so much easier to remember songs than to remember things that people tell you, or even to remember poems. And so if you have a geographical area represented by a song, it's like a map.
Yeah. And then you think of, even in our Western traditions, going back to the Iliad and the Odyssey and Homer, stories and philosophies and religious concepts and history were transmitted orally in a form that was really like poetry. And who knows how they actually said it. Maybe they were singing it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, how did you become involved in archaeology as the writer and photographer that you've been for decades now?
Oh, that's a personal story. I began as a French teacher. I studied French literature in college. I wrote my thesis on Emile Zola, and I was teaching French in New York City on the fifth floor of a building, which was the top floor, and there was one other room up there. I think it was the attic of the original house. The other room I discovered was a dark room, and I'd started doing a lot of photography in those days, and I got the key to the dark room and began using it. So I got into photography, and then photography, to leapfrog way ahead, brought me to Santa Fe and got me a job as an archaeological photographer working on the Arroyo Hondo excavations near Santa Fe as the record photographer. And so I was the record photographer, the scientific photographer on that dig for 3 summers, and that introduced me to archaeology. I met archaeologists. I was photographing artifacts as they were being uncovered. And then I began traveling around with my wife, Ruth, to visit ruins and ancient sites in the Southwest. And I found that there was no guidebook to these places, and there was very little in-depth information about these ruins for general readers. So I wrote a guidebook called Ancient Ruins of the Southwest, an archaeological guide, which I've just finished writing the 4th edition of.
Okay.
And so that was how I went from French to photography to archaeology to writing books.
And from the Northeast to the Southwest.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's a wonderful book with great photography and illustrations by David Grant Noble, edited by David Grant Noble, and lots of wonderful writers in it. And David will be speaking this coming Sunday at 3 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe on the corner of Galisteo and Water Street. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having this program, which has become an institution in Santa Fe's radio culture.
Well, thank you.